In the cinematic sea of prequels, sequels, reboots, and reimaginings, the Movie Retakes podcast considers the merits, needs, and desires for Hollywood's new takes on beloved movie classics. Brothers Chris and Matt Sully ask the questions, should they make it, or should they just leave it alone?
Mm-hmm.
And this is Sully.
This is regular size Sully. I kept waiting for you to say big Sully. yeah, we're the Sully brothers.
I gotta give you your dream shot. I'm gonna send you up against the best. You two characters are going to Top Gun.
Today's episode is Top Gun. Thanks for joining us.
It's so funny when we're doing stuff with folders and back and forth. I'm used to just being the only Sully in the room. So now I have to put like C Sully or M Sully or...
Yeah, that's
not
true.
Not MC Sully.
Well, we have one of those last names that's just... I think people enjoy saying it. It's a lot of fun to say. And I've always been Sully in a lot of circles as well. If we can't both be Sully, we'll just be turning around all the time.
Some sort of fight to the finish. Whoever comes out on top gets to keep the Sully name.
I'll probably just be running away. You can have it. I'll be Roger. Whatever.
You just totally change your... You do have a first name you could go by.
Yeah. Yeah. Like there's no Matts in the world. Well, anyway, we are the Sully Brothers, and we do appreciate you joining us for this episode of Movie Retakes. We would like you to follow, if you're not already following, over at Movie Retakes on Twitter. Going to be a lot of back and forth conversation and interaction there, so we do appreciate you joining us. Today, well, first off, I'd like to talk about what are you watching? You watching anything good on TV?
Yeah, we're recording this during all the stay-at-home stuff because of the coronavirus, and a lot of people are upset. I feel bad for anyone who is ill or who has passed. That sucks. It really does. I hate that we're all going through this. If you're those of us who are staying at home and honoring the distancing, the social distancing, it's giving me a lot of time to catch up on things. So I've been watching a lot of TV and movies. I caught up on a new show called Fleabag. I really like. I watched.
I've heard
good
stuff
about Ozark.
I've heard good.
Fleabag's funny.
Yeah,
very funny. Very different than what I expected based on the trailer and the image, the cover image for it on Amazon Prime.
Hmm.
Season 3 of Ozark, which if you're not watching Ozark, just a spectacular show with Jason Bateman, all drama, not the typical kind of thing you would expect from Jason Bateman, but I think he directs some episodes, he maybe even write on it, and it's brilliant. It's so good.
That's great.
Superstore, one of my favorite comedies. I'm always catching up on that one, and Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Those are like in my guaranteed rotation every week. And then rewatched Endgame the other day. And I think I have an emotional breakdown at different points every time I watch it. And then Shazam. I was right in the middle of Shazam before we started to record today, which I love Zach Levi. And I hadn't rewatched it since I saw it at theaters. So now seemed like the time. But then on top of all that, which seems like plenty, right? I've been getting out and running, staying distanced, but running. And listen to a lot of podcasts, not only as inspiration, but just because I love the podcast format. So you got me hooked back on Mark Maron, the WTF podcast. Mm-hmm. I've been listening to a lot of interviews on there with John Goodman and who was I just talking about? Edward Norton. There's been some real good ones this week. The ID10T podcast with Chris Hardwick, How I Built This, My Brother and Me, and then a shout out to my brother, to my buddy, who runs the Movie Jungle podcast, Brian. I've been listening to his episodes, and they're fantastic as well.
Wow, it is a lot. I feel ill-prepared, or I've just not been watching enough stuff. Not a lot of crossover there. Actually, other than Endgame, I think I haven't seen any of those shows you mentioned, or the movies. I am interested in both Fleabag and Ozark. I've heard a lot of good stuff about both. And I'm a big Jason Bateman fan. I like him a lot. Him in Arrested Development is just, he's so funny. But he's just a good actor in general. Like he nails drama and comedy and everything. He's good. Man, he's been around, the Batemans have been around for a long time too. Like what was the first
thing?
He
doesn't age.
Yeah, it's true. He does look really young still. That's crazy.
It's truly amazing. I think he's been around about as long as Keanu Reeves, and we call Keanu Reeves the ageless one, but honestly, Jason Bateman looks younger.
Yeah, those jerks. I'm sure they're wonderful men, but I haven't been podcast wise. I did actually listen to a couple of Mark and Me's because I was listening to Skip to the End, and those guys are kind of going their own ways, and so I wanted to listen to some more of their stuff, and so I listened to a couple of Mark and Me's, and I really enjoyed that. I followed Mark on Twitter, and he immediately followed me right back. So, kind of excited about that. And hopefully, he'll listen to this show as well, and we'll become podcast pals if that's a thing. I have been watching. We're rewatching Breaking Bad, which I put off for the longest time because I wasn't looking forward to it. But because it's so intense, like that show is, man, there's a couple episodes where you just, when the credits come up, you feel it. You've got some emotions. Things happen on that show, you know, and it gets to be a bit much. So it's one of those, like, we're really enjoying it. We are speeding through it pretty quickly. I think we're probably only like 4 episodes from the finale. And it's still just as good. It's a really good show. Like, from beginning to end, I think it's, there's nothing, it never really wanders away from its core elements. It never loses itself. It always just seems to have, it's very aware of what it is and where it needs to go. And I like that about a show.
Vince Gilligan is, is he underrated. He is such an amazing creator. Like, I will watch anything he makes from now on out. Better Call Saul, have you started that yet?
I have, yeah. I really enjoyed that show. Yeah,
he's nailing it with that too. Like, how could you take something, you know where it's gonna go, and he's still doing such a wonderful job of telling the story with that?
Yeah, well, I remember Bob Odenkirk on Breaking Bad, when he came on the screen, I was already a fan of his because I had seen him as a comedian and other things, and I'm pretty sure he's, did he come from Upright Citizens Brigade, or was it one of the other? Yeah, I guess we can look it up, huh? You look up Bob Odenkirk, and I'll it's like some other things. I am watching Westworld as well. I guess I'm an Aaron Paul fan now, which, you know, I'm rewatching Breaking Bad, and I'm watching Aaron Paul's performance during this whole thing, and masterful. When he first comes on, you're like, God, this guy's annoying, because he's supposed to be, like, his character is just, you're not supposed to be a big fan of him. He's just gets in the way. The way he talks is just so annoying, and you watch him develop throughout the show. Was it like 4 seasons or something? And by the end of it, you're like, man, this guy has really evolved. I mean, they both have. Everybody has. Like, there's nobody's the same person from the beginning of that show, and he did a tremendous job. And I was actually really looking forward to seeing him in Westworld, to see, you know, him as another character. Yeah. And I think he's doing a great job. Like, I think he's, I'm looking forward to seeing him in a lot of things. Also Same. Rewatched Isle of Dogs. I guess I'm in a rewatch sort of thing. This is the second time I think I've seen that movie. And man, just as solid. Beginning to end, that's got to be, I think it might be my favorite Wes Anderson movie right now. I'm a big fan of his, and I love everything he's done, but Isle of Dogs is just spot on perfect. It's hilarious. I don't know. Have you seen that one?
I sadly have not seen it, but it's been recommended to me many times, so it might be time to break down and do it.
Yeah, he just nailed it. Like, there's just so many moments in there where I just burst out laughing. And then my wife and I were going to do this exchange of movies that both of us, or one of us likes, that the other had never seen. So she had me watch Enough Said last night, and that's got Julie Louis-Dreyfus and, oh no, I don't want to blank on his name. Guy from Sopranos. You know, main guy. Oh, we'll just put
that guy.
James Gandolfini.
I have it up on the screen.
James Gandolfini. I'm sorry, James. I didn't mean to blank on your name, but I did. And it was really good. I think it's one of those that, it's a drama about basically middle-aged, divorced people starting to date someone again. And so it's very appropriate for us at this point, as far as our age group. Had I watched it in my 20s, I don't think I would have got it, you know, the same way. But you know, now that we're a certain age, you get things that you didn't get before, and so I think it's far more meaningful now than if something I had watched earlier on. But it was quite good. Yeah, both of them are good. I think that was the last anything he'd done, movie or television, before he died. I think he died the same year it came out.
You know, the notion of a movie having different meanings that you take away from it throughout your life is not something that dawned on me till the last couple years when somebody was talking about Christmas Vacation. And they're like, oh yeah, I saw Christmas Vacation through the kids' eyes when I first saw it. Now I'm seeing it through the parents' eyes. And then down the road, I'll probably see it from the grandparents' perspective. And I always thought that was pretty interesting that a movie could change that way throughout your lifetime.
Yeah, I can't remember if we mentioned that on a previous episode or not, but I felt the same way about the movie Parenthood, the Ron Howard movie.
Yes.
And yeah, I think we did talk about it, but the same exact thing where we watched that. We were younger when it came out. And there is every age bracket in there. You can watch it as a kid. Mm-hmm. And be, you know, Steve Martin's just generally comedic performance would be entertaining. You can watch it as a teenager and you'll connect with the teen drama in there. You can watch it as middle age. And then when we get older, I'm going to watch it again and we'll be connecting with all the grandparents that are in there. That movie literally will last our entire lifetime and be meaningful every time. So quite good.
Need a term for that.
I don't know. We'll have to come up with one.
Back to Bob Odenkirk. He was a writer on SNL from 87 to 91, and then it was Mr. Show
Mr.
that he
Show,
came from.
Oh, that's it.
Yeah, with Sarah Silverman, Jack Black.
David Cross, right?
David Cross, exactly.
That's what it was.
I love that guy.
Yeah, my goof.
Green Quarter.
Upright Citizens Brigade, we had a couple other people come out of there. I don't know why I was thinking he must look somewhat like somebody else on that show. But yeah, Mr. Show with Bob and David. Yeah, and David Cross was also in with Jason Bateman there and Arrested Development.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Very
he
funny.
He was the Never Nude.
Yeah.
I blew myself.
Come help Daddy get his rocks off. That was like one of the most hilarious and terrible lines of that show.
Oh wait, what was the anal rapist?
Yeah.
Oh god, so bad. So yeah. Funny.
That's one of those shows I think we've rewatched that one a couple of times. I know we'll watch it again. Arrested Development, it's just brilliant.
The first three seasons.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm talking about. Sorry, I just meant the first three seasons. I'm not really acknowledging any of the later stuff. So one of the things I want to talk about before we get into Top Gun today, too, is you mentioned kind of people staying at home. And one of those things it's been affecting is the theater releases. Things are getting pushed back. And I know that when we talk about release dates on this, we're probably going to be wrong now just because things are not happening at the time when people want them to. So now we're looking at release dates for movies being pushed back by months. I was looking and saw that most of the April and May releases are now not going to come out until August. So they're going more for, well, that's an end of summer release. But there's stuff like the new James Bond was supposed to come out at the end of March, and it's not going to come out until the end of November. So huge shift there. And I guess it's one of those things too, where you're aiming for a certain time slot, like you're either a summer blockbuster or you're that Thanksgiving one or, you know, the Christmas or whatever. So I guess you can really only move into so many time slots. You don't all of a sudden want to show up in not near any holiday or any time anybody goes to the movies, which I guess is kind of strange, but that's part of the game, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, some of these studios, a year, 2 years, 3 years in advance, will start locking down dates. And they'll just say, you know, untitled project, even though they know what they're thinking about putting there. But that way they can start scaring everybody else off from that date. Because you don't want to go up against the next big Marvel movie on your opening weekend if you can avoid it.
Yeah. Yeah, and some of the stuff, if they're not releasing whatever the release date might be, they're also moving stuff to streaming earlier too. Like Onward, I believe, is already available, mm-hmm. and or is going to be soon. Frozen 2 came out really early. We watched that one. But other ones are going to come out early too, like Invisible Man, Bloodshot, Birds of Prey, which I'm upset that I didn't go to the, I wanted to go to the movies to see that one. I was not looking forward to it at first. I thought Birds of Prey was not going to be good, even though I'm a big fan of Margot Robbie. I think she's great. And then it got great reviews. And then I was wanting to go see it and just never did. But so I'm happy that it's going to come out early. Call of the Wild is also listed as coming out early. And I, with Harrison Ford and terrible looking CG, like
I don't get it.
There's no excuse for that. We are in a time where I can probably put together a seamless CG character into our Skype call here within a few minutes, like from the laptop processing power I have. So I don't see how a studio can possibly put out anything with bad CG. Like, what are you doing?
I don't get it. And in this day and age, too, when they couldn't use real dogs, like, what is this dog doing they couldn't get real dogs to do? I don't get it.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
I'll be skipping that one.
Can you spend, I don't know, go invest in a few more doggy snacks and spend 5 more minutes with the trainer to get the dog to run through snow the direction you want to go to? Why did you decide to do all CG on this? It was just a bad choice. And I feel bad for Harrison. Like, this looks like he's been just jolted into that time in an actor's career where you're like, oh, that's who I am now. I'm going to do either going to be these terrible family films. Not terrible, but, you know, there is a transition here. We have to acknowledge that. So is he going to be the old guy now? It's like, is that his role? The old guy who hangs out with the dog and the snowy
tundras?
It'll
be tough for us to see it, having grown up with him as the leading sex symbol guy. And now to see him as a grandfather, but for like my niece, your daughter, like that's who she sees. And then one day she'll be like, oh, that's the guy that was in the Star Wars movie I finally learned to love.
Yeah, that's true. Well, yeah, we look at, yeah, she's not a fan right now. Yeah, that's why I'll look at these pictures of old actors and stuff, you know, that we see them as old folks now. And then you go back and you look at them and you're young, like, damn, he was handsome. Or she was hot.
Betty White. Betty White when she was young. Stunning.
Yeah, she's a nice-looking lady.
I mean, she's still an attractive lady, but I never saw her that way. I didn't grow up with her as 28-year-old Betty White.
Right. Yeah. Like, yeah, so that's the same thing that happens to us. Yeah, we're watching all these people that used to be young, watching them age and trying not to acknowledge that it's happening to us at the same time. But
I just covered all the mirrors in my house, so I don't have to see that in IRL.
Yeah, I could figure I could stockpile hair dye, or I can just stop looking at myself. So no gray hairs here.
I haven't looked in a mirror in a decade. I have no idea what I look like.
Speaking of things getting older, let's talk about Top Gun.
There you go.
This came out in 1986. Crazy. That's a long time ago.
God.
And Tom, like, speaking of getting older, I mean, he still looks good, but the man has aged. He's not a boy anymore. And watching it again, he looked like a kid. Like, didn't he look so young?
Totally.
And I think I have in here how old he was. But so let's go through the facts, run down the list here. So Top Gun synopsis is, as students at the United States Navy's Elite Fighter Weapons School compete to be best in the class, one daring young pilot learns a few things from a civilian instructor that are not taught in the classroom. Oh. Actors in this are Tom Cruise, Kelly McGillis, Val Kilmer, Anthony Edwards, Tom Skerritt, Michael Ironside, Tim Robbins, Clarence Gilliard Jr., John Stockwell, and James Tolkien. Woo, man. There's some good folks in there.
For real.
Directed by Tony Scott. This is Ridley's younger brother by about 7 years. He died in 2012 at age 68 with 29 directing credits under his belt. Along with Top Gun, Tony directed Beverly Hills Cop 2, Days of Thunder, The Last Boy Scout, True Romance, Crimson Tide, Enemy of the State, and Man on Fire. Yeah.
Wow.
Wow. Prior to Top Gun, however, his only movie was The Hunger, a vampire love triangle movie starring Catherine Deneuve, David Bowie, and Susan Sarandon. I never saw that, I'm pretty sure. Maybe it was on Showtime or something, one of those late night ones where I was half asleep, hoping there was some nudity or something when I was a kid. But, well, nothing's changed. Still hoping for some nudity. But, you know, I'm going to go ahead and take a cue from the fact that David Bowie's in it. Not to knock on him, but probably not going to be top stuff, top shelf sort of Top Gun activity here. Susan Sarandon's in it. I'd see it for her. I love her.
Same.
But yeah.
Especially in that era.
I'll probably never watch The Hunger. I don't know. I haven't even looked up to see what the rating was on it. I'm assuming it's poor. Let's take a look.
Our next episode, should they make a sequel to The Hunger?
Even hungrier.
Not going to happen.
Well, first up comes Hunger Games. Let's see. 1983. A 6.7, but that's IMDb.
Yeah, you can't trust that.
Yeah, I can't trust their rating system. It's not good. Yeah, I'm pretty sure when they put a movie up there, it automatically is at a 5. Like, they don't start at 0 or anything. Nobody has to rate anything. It's already, like, at the midway point. So the writers of Top Gun, this is Jim Cash and Jack Epps Jr., who also collaborated on The Secret of My Success. That was a funny movie. Turner and Hooch, also funny. Dick Tracy, which nobody really liked, but there's some value in that. Like, I don't know. It's, you know, it's another comic book movie. Like, that was a hard sell. People weren't watching those at the time.
Yeah.
But it's got some cool visuals. They did a lot of neat stuff with the makeup and everything. But yeah, it's not a great movie. Well, there's another example. Madonna's a key role in that. And so I guess anytime you have, you're working off the popularity of your actor as their career as a singer. Yeah. Not a good sign. These guys also wrote Anaconda, which I don't know how much writing really went into Anaconda. I mean, really?
It was a post-it note. Just outlined basic ideas. That was it.
Snake eats person. Person dies. Somebody else freaks out. Snake eats next person. Yeah, I don't know. I'd like to read the script of that one. Guys did some good stuff. Now, Top Gun came out in 1986. This is the international year of peace, according to the United Nations. It was also the first PC virus came out that year, the Challenger and Chernobyl disaster, same year. I didn't even realize that until I looked that up. Ooh. Mad cow disease, if anybody remembers that one. The Human Genome Project and the Oprah Winfrey Show. Also, Hands Across America, and the average movie ticket cost $3.71.
Cool. What?
Yeah, now it's like
I don't remember that.
I got to take out a small loan to take the family to the movie now. Timothy Dalton is announced to be the next James Bond. Which, how many movies did he do? Maybe two.
Yeah, not many.
He was all right though. I liked him. Cary Grant dies at 82. Pixar Animation Studios is founded. Isn't that crazy? It's just one of those things. Dang. You feel like has always been around. Disney Studios is saved from bankruptcy by The Great Mouse Detective, despite losing in the box office to Steven Spielberg's first animated movie, An American Tale. An American Tale broke the record for largest financial... whatever. I guess I wrote that right.
More money.
It made a lot of money. Money. For an animated movie on opening weekend. So that's what it's holding there, too. And, of course, Disney was the one who held that record before with The Rescuers. So... Disney's, you know, not doing so great at the time. Barely keeping head above water there. Tom Cruise.
Should have bought stock that year.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, and I remember we talked about that before. It's like the only thing they had going for them was the old stuff, and all they would do is put it back in the vault for a few years to build up demand and then bring it back out. So, you know, it's slightly enhanced version. The color is slightly more colorful or whatever. I'm like, okay, great. Yeah, I'll throw $30 more at you. Thanks a bunch. Tom Cruise hit it big in 1983 with Risky Business. Great movie. That is a great movie.
Yep.
Yeah. 1985, he did Legend with Ridley Scott. I know people are kind of on the fence about that one, but I like it. And again, it's all about the visuals. That is just an incredible looking film. At 24, he was primed to be a star, and Top Gun was the movie that made him a household name. 24. I can't imagine. Kelly McGillis had co-starred in Witness with Harrison Ford in 1985. Val Kilmer had come off two comedies, Top Secret and Real Genius, both fantastic movies.
God, so good.
Edwards, Skerritt, and Ironside were the more experienced actors. Anthony Edwards was in Fast Times at Ridgemont High in 1982, Revenge of the Nerds in 84. Skerritt had done about two dozen movies, including Alien and MASH, and just as many TV spots. Ironside was just as busy, probably most known to American audiences as Ham Tyler on the television series V. You remember that one?
Yeah, so good.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. That was neat. I think that was probably one of the bigger sci-fi series, other than like Battlestar Galactica, you know, the original Battlestar Galactica before then. That was, but everybody was watching V, man. That was a cool show.
It was an actual event. I mean, it was a thing because you had to be there at a certain time and date, or there was no recording it unless you were rich and had a VCR.
Yeah, there's no, we didn't stream stuff back then. We didn't binge watch anything. You all got together and you shut up. You got your popcorn, you sat down, and you said, shh, V's on, starting.
Streaming back then was taking a whiz.
Yeah. Wasn't happening. So 1986 box office hits that year were Crocodile Dundee, Platoon, Karate Kid Part 2, Star Trek 4, The Voyage Home, Back to School, Aliens, The Golden Child, Ruthless People, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and Top Gun came out, as its title implied, right on top. So think about that. You've got a Star Trek movie, an Eddie Murphy movie, a James Cameron film, which I would say at the time maybe his name didn't carry as much weight.
True.
John Hughes, though, with Ferris Bueller. I mean, he was pretty well known. The person that came out on top, the movie that came out on top, was Top Gun. Like, beat up all those. Domestic gross was $176 million worldwide. The domestic gross is $176 million. Worldwide box office, $353 million.
Off $3 tickets.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's bigger now.
I mean, now what's the average ticket now? Like 15, 16, 17 bucks at least?
Yeah.
So multiply that by five.
Depends on how many dimensions you're buying.
$1 billion movie.
Yeah. If you need to get into the third through the sixth dimension, then it's going to be a few more bucks. Yeah, and that was on a $15 million budget for Top Gun. So
wow, that was it? Dang, that's free. They made it with a coupon.
That's insane.
Like, that's nuts.
Whoever does a project, that's like me putting to, that's like like a painter going out and spending $20 on paints, although it's more than that, I'm sure. Painting something. Okay, let's say he spent a month on it, and then he sells it for $1 million. Like, that's the equivalent there. What? Really? I mean, yeah, there's art in it, but $353 million over $15 million? That's insane. Nothing.
But it's a rare story. Think of how many movies barely make back their money or, you know, don't make that much. There's especially in 1986, there were maybe like 10 to 15 movies that made big money.
I think it was becoming more commonplace in this. Yeah, but to that level, no. Yeah, you're right. Like, you're hoping for one a year. The studio's hoping for one a year. They're going to put out more movies just to kind of offset. But you're right. Sometimes they don't make the money back. Sometimes they break out even. And I'm sure there's plenty of stories and details we don't know, you know, where they're going to fib the numbers a little bit so that studios don't look so bad. But then, you know, we were just talking about Disney was about to go under. So even a powerhouse studio or ones we view as that now, they're all in danger at some point. Like, everybody's always on the brink. That only takes a couple of big failures for them to be in a bad way. And that kind of segues over into a special thing I wanted to talk about today is producers. People don't often talk about producers. They're the names we see very often and prominently in movie credits. And we know some of their names, even if we don't realize we do, like Frank Marshall, Kathleen Kennedy, Brian Grazer. Like, you know those names. You see them, and you're like, yeah, I've seen that before. You may not be able to say from what, but you know their names. There's actors that turn producer, like Michael Douglas. He's been a longtime producer. I think he jumped in that pretty early. I want to say, like, right after the one where she boils his rabbit. Now I'm blanking on things. Anyway, but he was a producer pretty early on, and Tom Hanks too. So I've been a producer for quite some time. You're not going to help me out with that one? You didn't look it up?
I can see the poster in my head, and I can't come up with it.
Thanks
the first
a bunch.
Thought was nope, I have no thought.
Okay, great.
It's not happening.
We'll fix it in post. Sometimes producers just throw money at the movies. They reap the rewards, but the overall influence on how the film's made varies quite a bit. For Top Gun, however, I feel two producers, Don Simpson and Jerry Bruckheimer, deserve special note. Why? Well, you'll hear why soon. Bruckheimer and Simpson had only collaborated on one movie before, Flashdance. Now, a lot of people are going to hear that and dismiss the film. It's rated 36% by Rotten Tomatoes. But it did amazing at the box office, making over $200 million worldwide. And that's the Simpson-Bruckheimer MO as producers. The movies they make aren't great, but they make a lot of money. As a pair, they produced Beverly Hills Cop, Days of Thunder, Bad Boys, Crimson Tide, and The Rock. They're all enjoyable action movies, okay? But apart from Beverly Hills Cop, they put action and machismo far above character and dialogue. I mean, you can't deny, like, a lot of it's about what's going to blow up next or, you know, what's going to be the best next car chase, whatever. Don Simpson died in 96. So unfortunately, they didn't get to continue on and do a lot more stuff. And I'm sure they would have. Bruckheimer did continue on producing Armageddon, Gone in 60 Seconds, Remember the Titans, Con Air, Pearl Harbor, Black Hawk Down, a whole lot more. But I bring those movies up specifically because of how they look and feel. And normally it's a director and cinematographer that give a movie its visual personality. And yeah, Michael Bay had his hands on a few of those movies, applying his chaotic camera and editing style, commonly known as Bayhem. But almost every one of those movies had a different cinematographer. I did actually look that up because I thought, well, maybe there's, you know, a lot of these crews, they'll work together, you know, over and over again, because you get a nice, it's a family at some point, and you figure out what works and you do that. But they had all different cinematographers, and that to me is kind of crazy. But if you think back on all those movies, you see there's a unifying sort of treatment to the worlds, the people within those films, and that's all Bruckheimer. He's got a commercial vision that seems to feed what audiences crave. It's what plants crave, that's what I was thinking. So he gave us Pirates of the Caribbean and the National Treasure series. He crossed into television with CSI and The Amazing Race. It's this easy segue into television that made me realize just what Bruckheimer is. He's an ad man. His movies Yep. are like lengthy commercials focused on creating a certain image, having scenes that look cool, make a great trailer, but they have little value outside the scene. So imagine The Rock condensed into 45 seconds. You've got action, explosions, car chases, cameras moving all over with this saturated color scheme, then a shot of Axe body spray, or the volleyball sequence from Top Gun, then cut to an open cooler with Bud Light cans spilling up from the ice. I mean, you can see it. It's natural in there. These are just big, cool commercials that sell us things. Even the concept for Top Gun came from a magazine. Bruckheimer says he saw the cover of California Magazine with two jets inverted and said, "This is really cool. This is something we should do." When he was selling the idea to Tom Cruise, Tony Scott showed him photographs of handsome, muscly men posing for the camera and said, "This is what I want you to look like." Bruckheimer, Scott, Bay, they all share this quality of concern over what's cool, and I'd say it was wrong if it wasn't so successful. They're all ad guys making visually stimulating commercials to sell products, where the product they're selling is the commercial itself. These guys don't make high drama, emotional, explorative projects. Their movies are flat, disposable, entertainment value, which gets butts in seats. They're not great movies or television, but they make a lot of money. And as a producer, despite what other influence you may have over the film, making money is your main responsibility. And with sequels on the horizon for Top Gun, Beverly Hills Cop, Bad Boys, and Pirates of the Caribbean, when is there not a sequel to Pirates of the Caribbean come out? Making money is exactly what Bruckheimer is going to be doing. All right, so that's my spiel on Bruckheimer. I did feel it was important to talk about it because you do see it, right? Like it's that sort of world he's built.
No, it's interesting that you honed in on that because before we chatted, when I just made my notes watching the film, I just wrote Simpson and Bruckheimer. Because when I started really starting to understand more about going to the movies and what I liked and other movies that I wanted to seek out, I remember watching the openings for the movies like The Rock and Con Air, and you'd see the tree with the lightning and the Simpson and Bruckheimer, and I'm like, I like when this comes up on the screen. Like, who are these guys? And so I started to learn more about the films that they worked on, and still to this day, when I see the tree with the lightning and I see Bruckheimer, I'm like, oh, hell yeah. I'm know I'm going to like this at least for the first viewing. And you're right. There's something to the way that they pull their movie together that is just made to make money at the box office. They just know the process of how to get butts and seats for that event of the movie. They do a wonderful job with it.
Mm-hmm. And they all have rewatchability too. I mean, I'm kind of diminishing their, in a lot of ways. I mean, like I said, they're not high drama or anything. Nobody's going to pull out a script for any of those movies and teach that as here's how you write a screenplay or anything. They put together a good project, and you sit down and shit. I've watched The Rock, I don't know, a dozen times, and I love it every time because you know what you're going to get. Like it's exactly what you think of an action movie. Well, what was it like when people got their new sound systems at home, when everybody was buying speakers and stuff at home, there was only a couple movies you would put on to test, and I think one of them was the Armageddon. Like everybody would watch that, or The Rock.
Absolutely,
you know, like these are things you know you're going to have some high quality explosions, audio and visual on all that stuff. All right, so that said, let's talk Top Gun. We both rewatched it. Rotten Tomatoes says 54%.
What's wrong with them?
I'm not in disagreement.
I want to know, okay, so if Rotten Tomatoes gives it that number, is that been that number for a long time, or over time as this movie has aged, has it slipped? Do they have a history button in Rotten Tomatoes?
That's a great idea.
What it used to be?
Yeah, they should have a graph to show us over time, because yeah, there's probably influence. Yeah. Like when the new one comes out, there's going to be a whole lot of people doing like we're doing, watching it again.
Yep.
So it would be kind of neat to see hell, if you kept that up for generations, what does the generations say about this movie?
I dare say if you'd have polled people in 1986 in a similar fashion, this would have ranked in the 80s or 90s pretty easily. I mean, this was it. This was at the center of pop culture at the time. This was as big as it got.
Yeah, it was massive. I mean, what it made at the box office, that says something. There was... yeah, everybody coming out of the theater, if you'd asked anybody, they'd be like, that's the best movie I've ever seen. It was massive. Well, and I think, I can't remember if it's in our trivia that we're going to get to later, but this was huge for the Navy or the Air Force or whatever. It was the military sign-ups were big after this. Isn't that crazy how that works? Like, you actually get people that excited. They're like, yeah, now I want to go fly a jet.
Not. You kidding me? Every time it gets a little damp outside, I'm turning corners and hitting the e-brake like it's Fast and Furious, man. I want to live that life, quarter mile at a time.
Yeah.
Sorry, I digress. We're talking about planes, not cars.
Well, yeah, it's all speed, right? Like that's what that kind of ties into. For me, I don't think I've even seen this movie that much. This might be the third time I've seen Top Gun. Possibly. I don't know. It had been a long time, I'll tell you that much. Probably since before my 20s. I don't think I've watched it in my 20s, maybe. But it's okay. I mean, it's got some action. It's fun with they're up at the jets, and there's some drama. Not a lot of comedy, really. But mostly, I think it's not so good. The script isn't that great. I feel like Tom Cruise might have been miscast. I like Tom Cruise a lot, but I feel like had we gotten Val Kilmer in that main role instead of the supporting role, honestly, I think it would have been a lot better. I think we would have got more depth. I think the relationship with Kelly McGillis, I think, would have made more sense, because I look at Tom now, like looking at him in Top Gun, and he looks so young. Like he looks like he's 18, and I look at Kelly McGillis, and I'm like, that's a woman. Like, what is she doing with this kid? which, you know, that has a time and place too, I'm sure. But for believability of them actually connecting in any sort of real romantic sort of scenario, no, I would have put her with Val Kilmer before I would have put her with Tom Cruise. And I feel like it was a weird move with I guess I'm just going to talk about Val Kilmer. With Val Kilmer, like, coming off of two comedy roles like that, and then I think people might have expected him to be funny in this, and he doesn't have any funny lines at all. If anything, he's the rock, like the moral compass in this. He's always trying to steer Mitchell Maverick in the right direction.
You're everyone's problem. That's because every time you go up in the air, you're unsafe. I don't like you because you're dangerous.
That's right. Nice, man. I am dangerous.
And that's another thing, too, is... So Maverick's supposed to be this bad boy that we're supposed to support, but he's a jerk, man. He just keeps doing all these wrong things. Like, get on board. I'm Val Kilmer in this movie. I'm like, can you just do the right thing? Can you just fly the way you're supposed to fly?
Yeah.
Because... you're messing everything up. You're going to get somebody killed. Oh, does he? Now, he's not really responsible. But
well, he does spill a lot of coffee.
Yeah, that's right.
Those flybys of the tower were dangerous.
Tower, this is Ghost Rider requesting a flyby.
Negative, Ghost Rider. The pattern is full.
Yeah, but overall, like, I'd say that the best things that come out of Top Gun is the visuals. It does look cool. Like, this was, I think, some of the beginnings of that look, that Bruckheimer sort of look and feel. So that for the time period was new, and I think it was pretty neat. There is some decent action sequences with the jets. You do get some, you know, some loud noises with all that. Like, it's kind of exciting. And I don't know that I think the Iron Eagle movies were still new at the same time too. So we didn't have a lot of jet movies for that sort of activity. I want to say the second one when I was looking up stuff was coming out around the same time. But what else? I mean, Tom Skerritt is great in this. Michael Ironside's great. Oh, what'd you find?
The first Iron Eagle actually came out in January of 86.
Okay.
So same year the first one came out, which is pretty interesting.
Well, and those went on to have like five more of those. I think I'm pretty sure I remember watching those on VHS. That was a whole franchise there. But overall, not a whole lot of redeeming stuff in this. I mean, it's a good one-time view, but I'll probably never watch it again. The music's probably the best part. I mean, you throw a Kenny Loggins song at anything, and it's going to be solid gold. I'll say if you'd had a different soundtrack nationwide, there'd be a different conversation about this movie. The rating on Rotten Tomatoes would be like a 30-something percent because the music's really, really good.
Yeah, I made some notes as I was watching. I like to try to focus on the film as much as possible, so I'll just have my phone out and I'll jot down just bullet points. But these are the takeaways for me that I do stop long enough to jot down. First off, right off the bat, and you segued to it nicely, is the music. Like, again, we've talked about it with other movies. In that time period, they knew how to get a song to represent a film in a way unlike is done today, I think. And the opening music to Top Gun, once again, I could hear somebody off in the distance barely playing that, and it'd be like, oh yeah, Top Gun. Like, instantly you make that connection.
Yeah.
We already talked about Simpson and Bruckheimer. I made a note about that. I find it funny going to IMDb. If you look at the main cast, they list stars: Tom Cruise, Tim Robbins, Kelly McGillis, so on, so on. Tim Robbins is in the movie for maybe like 10 seconds, and we don't really have any interaction with him at all.
He's like, got a few lines. Yeah, there was a time where I was like, is that Tim Robbins? Like, you're looking at him.
Exactly.
And you're like, I don't know. It kind of sounds like, kind of looks like him, but I'm not certain.
He played Merlin. And I'm not quite sure, like, at the time, I know he wasn't a huge actor by any means, but, like, he's a good actor. I'm surprised. I feel like he had more parts than they got cut because they weren't important to the story. Yeah. I bet that's what happened.
Yeah.
James Tolkien, who played, Stinger in the film. He's the old bald-headed guy that you'll recognize as the principal from Back to the Future.
But you remember one thing. You screw up just this much, you'll be flying a cargo plane full of rubber dog shit out of Hong Kong.
I forgot about him, to be honest, outside of Back to the Future. So it was pleasant to be reminded that he was in that. And then I looked it up, and he was a part of a lot of great 80s movies, including Back to the Future, Masters of the Universe, War Games, and interestingly enough, on his IMDb page, there was a movie he was in 2 years later called Viper.
Huh.
And Viper was Tom Skerritt's call sign in Top Gun. Totally unrelated.
Oh, okay.
It, like, I was like, oh, is this some sort of spinoff?
That'd be cool.
No, Viper was a different character, so, but I thought that was interesting. And Cougar, played by John Stockwell, in the movie, when I first saw him, I had to pause it. I'm like, that looks like, that's Lucas Black from Fast and Furious Tokyo Drift.
Oh.
Like, it looked like the same damn person. I couldn't get over, like, you could put those two pictures side by side all day long, and I'd fight you on which one was which.
See, I thought you...
I thought that was pretty interesting.
I thought we were going to recognize him from the same movie. I think it was called My Science Project. Do you remember that?
Yes.
Yeah, because that was one of those... I think it was Showtime or whatever. That was one of those movies that they'd play, like, a million times, and whenever you'd catch it on, it didn't matter where it was in the movie, you'd still watch the whole movie, because it was...
Oh, yeah.
Like, him and, what, Fisher Stevens, I think, was in that?
I think so, yeah. And it was a classic, like, B-80s flick.
Yeah, and, what's his name? Dennis, no, I can't remember. Fatal Attraction, by the way, was the movie I was trying to get to
earlier. I got there, but I couldn't find a place to bring it up.
Right.
it was John Stockwell, Fisher Stevens, Dennis Hopper were all in My Science Project, which, you know, come to think of it, I have not thought about that movie in many years, but it was on a lot at the time. I want to go back and rewatch that again.
It's good. Like, it's basically kind of one of those, every once in a while a movie comes out, and I call these like a special effects sampler, where the movie was made just to show off these different special effects that they could do at the time. And that's pretty much what this is. They just had, like, it all takes place in the high school, and they make this weird machine that is not totally dissimilar from the machine in, you had just mentioned Masters of the Universe.
Where
it kind of opens these portals and things like that. And so that's kind of what happens in My Science Project. And just hilarity and weird things ensue, and they have to battle different demons to close this portal anyway. Yeah, but I can't remember what we're talking about now other than Top Gun.
That came out the year before. I was going on the how John Stockwell looked like Lucas Black.
Yeah.
Which I thought was funny. And I'm like one of the only people on the planet that could tell you who Lucas Black is in a heartbeat, just because I love Tokyo Drift so much, like way more than any human being should. And then the final note, getting back to Top Gun, that I made, and I'm going to hold to this one. I feel pretty strongly about this. Who the hell plays volleyball in jeans?
Yeah, that's weird.
What the? Like, I know you guys wanted to look real good out there. Couldn't you look real nice shirtless in a pair of OP shorts?
Yeah, I can't imagine.
Like, do they all just have bad legs?
Maybe. Maybe they all have chicken legs.
They all skipped leg day so they could just look really good from the waist. That's what it was. Right. That's what happened.
It was the vernal equinox. They had to skip leg day. Yeah, because I can't imagine the swampy, that sort of activity that resulted in that. Like, I hope they didn't go. I think he did go somewhere directly after that. Didn't he drive over to her house?
He went to Kelly McGillis's house, and the first thing he said is, I'm going to go take a shower, to which she should have said, yeah, you reek.
Yeah, that's right.
And you're tracking all this sand into my house that was stuck to your wet jeans. What the hell?
Good point. Yeah, the rest of that movie should have been people stepping aside and be like, why is there sand everywhere? Like, I just can't get it out. Like, the sand is that way. Like, it's in your clothes.
Some sort of...
It's in your hair.
Some sort of, like, Naked Gun-esque pun or making fun of Top Gun, where, like, by the end of the movie, you don't see anything but sand on the screen.
Yeah. Yeah, Goose is dying in the middle of the Indian Ocean there, and just he's still picking sand off his face. Like, it's in my helmet.
That could have been what caused some of the flight problems, is sand in the equipment.
Probably, yeah.
Oh, boy.
It's all the sand.
Yeah, so... Those were the notes I took away. I mean, as far as rating the movie goes, I'm with you. I had only seen it, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 times before, and it was the first time in probably 15, 20 years that I've rewatched it. I felt like, all in all, it's a solid film. It definitely was a subject matter unlike anything that we've seen in a long since, really, other than Iron Eagle, which is funny that you referenced that, because I immediately thought of it as well. But... Like, no one's doing movies like that anymore. When's the last time you saw some sort of plane flying movie? Jets. I can't recall. They are a small part in other films. They're just usually on a scene where they deployed off a craft in the ocean to go tear something up. But
that's true. Making it a main focus, I don't think, has happened in a while. You know, one of the things, too, is I could remember, before watching this again, enough of the movie. The gist of it, basically, you know, there's drama, you know, his partner dies, there's a romantic sort of thing. I couldn't remember how big Meg Ryan's part actually was, and it's not really big. I thought it would be actually larger. But I could not for the life of me remember the last act, like how it resolved. I'm like, do they go to war? Is there a, I can't remember who the enemy is and what actually happens. And spoiler alert, basically it's just like one sort of dogfight at the end. They do finally get called. It's a real mission. People get shot at. There's real bullets and stuff. But it's not a real war. Like they don't, it's just some sort of offshoot. People were in the airspace they shouldn't be in, and there's a fight, and that's it. And then apparently he gets a golden pass. Like he's in one dogfight, and he's like, now he can retire and do whatever he wants. I didn't understand that part at all. Like, shouldn't he have to serve for quite a while?
He just got out of school, kids.
Like, yeah.
He's 18.
Unless I didn't understand the time frame, like where they sped something up, but it looks like they graduate, he goes and immediately is called into a fight. He has, what, two interactions with three or four different planes, and then he comes back, it's deemed successful, and they say, now you can go on and do whatever you want. You can have a career doing anything you want. And he decides he's going to go teach the Top Gun school. And that's it? That's what you do? Yeah, I don't think that's how it works. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know.
Well, you know, the movies aren't always exactly documentaries.
What? Everything is the truth. I have to believe everything.
I mean, with the exception of the MCU, all documentary. Yeah. But all this other stuff, I don't know.
All right. Well, so, oops, sorry. Now we should get into talking about our own pitches. Obviously, we bring up Top Gun because they're going to be releasing Top Gun Maverick. This is going to be a sequel to the original many, many years in the future. And I only mean that, you know, this was 1986 when Top Gun came out, and now it's going to be 2020. And as you know on the show, or as you don't know, we like to come up with our own pitches for what we would see or write as a sequel to these original movies. And sometimes they're going to, well, I think every time we've done this, it's been a true sequel. But I imagine at some point somebody's going to be like, well, I want to make this an animated feature that goes into the history of some side character that was on screen for half a second. But until then, it seems like most of these are straight up sequels. But the concept is, yes, there's a movie that's already going to come out, and it's already been made, and it has its own story, but we're telling a different story, probably different. Maybe at some point it's going to overlap and be the exact same story that they've told, and that'll be amazing. But at this point, with our knowledge of what's actually coming out, this is our pitch on what we would think the movie should be. You usually go first. Do you want to go first, or do you want me to go first?
You go first this
all
time.
Right. Okay, cool. All right, so a few caveats here, if I can remember all these. Please forgive my ignorance of culture. Basically, I know nothing about anything. I don't know anything about jets. I don't know anything about the Air Force or the Navy. I don't know anything about very little on the Saudi Arabian culture that I'm going to get into here. So forgive me where all the mistakes I've made. I would obviously do a lot more research if I'm actually going to write this thing. So other than this, 10-minute synopsis or however long this is. So this is, probably terrible. I am going to start also by saying that this is way more of a drama. This is not supposed to be like a Bruckheimer sort of, you know, fast action movie here. This is going to be straight up drama. There is going to be some jets involved still, but it's not going to be the same kind of movie. It's going to have a different feel. I never do this, but I'm starting off with a quote because I found this quote and I like it. Terrorism does not belong to any culture or religion or political system. And that's a quote from King Abdullah, Saudi Arabian king. American pilots are zooming at high speeds, practicing skilled formation changes when unidentified planes enter the airspace. These pilots are in similar fighter jets, only the pilots are communicating in Arabic. A chase ensues where several missile locks are evaded and tension is high. Before anyone is shot down, however, the voice of Air Ops Command calls the pilots to return to base, and we see both American and Saudi fighters descend on the same runway. We're at Naval Air Station Pensacola, Florida, home to the Blue Angels and one of the Navy's largest international aviator training centers. The students from the combat training simulation meet to debrief, the American and Saudi pilots exchanging friendly banter and jabs before class begins. Only one of the men appears unable to see the humor in the situation, a Saudi pilot locked into a grimace. Pete Maverick Mitchell appears before the class, older, more at ease, wedding ring on his finger, and a few extra pounds around his middle. He takes the group through their mistakes, highlighting the one dangerous American pilot, Evan, that breaks all the rules yet still gets his enemy. Maverick both admires and berates Evan, the young, reckless pilot that reminds him too much of himself. When the class adjourns, the irate Saudi, Sefa Amin, that's his character name, confronts the rogue American. And when the scuffle gets heated, Sefa pulls a gun and shoots Evan down, along with two others. Maverick intervenes and kills Sefa. Yeah, twist. Didn't Whoa. See that coming. After the funerals, no. We hear the international students are uneasy the Saudis actually returning to their home country. International relations are in need of repair, and Maverick is getting orders to go to Saudi Arabia to help with a local training facility, an effort to keep trust among the two peoples. He doesn't want to go, but the higher-ups explain that he and his dogfighting school are outdated concepts that have no place in modern American aviation. Drone and missile technology has made pilots like him obsolete to U.S. needs, but America still needs to sell old tech to their allies. If they lose those allies, they lose a lot of money. If the Saudis won't come to the U.S., the U.S. goes to the Saudis. Maverick travels to Saudi Arabia. We see from his simple packing and leaving his keys in his small apartment that he has no family to leave behind. He finds his new office at King Abdul Aziz Air Base in Tehran. His reception is mixed among the Royal Saudi Air Force in all rankings, and the other U.S. Air Force personnel already working there make fun of Maverick for taking the training so seriously. They know how useless traditional jet fighters are and show off their drone control room, even killing a sheep in a field with incredible accuracy. Maverick is troubled by his part in the death of the Saudi pilot, but keeps his focus on training better pilots. Among the squadron's F-15s and Bell 412s, Maverick discovers a handful of abandoned F-4 Phantoms, decades-old fighters like his father flew in Vietnam. I had to look that up. One of the Maverick's top students, who seems just as troubled and distant from his colleagues, joins Maverick in repairing the old planes. While most of the men speak English, Khalid speaks little at all. He's intense, almost frightening, but in helping each other with the planes, they learn enough of each other's languages to get the job done. And the pair of men develop a tenuous trust. Eventually, Khalid invites Maverick to dinner. Maverick is unsure, but he sees the man as the closest thing he has to a friend and doesn't want to offend him. Maverick visits Khalid's home, surprising the Amin family. Khalid's parents and younger siblings are all there as well, with his knowledge of customs, but Khalid mysteriously leaves Maverick behind. The dinner continues, and discussion is light until panicked word comes from a neighbor that there has been a terrorist attack at the local market. The family and Maverick rush to help the wounded and put out fires, and some of the locals are upset by Maverick's presence. The Amins invite Maverick to stay with them for the evening rather than going back to the base. Before settling in for the evening at the Amin home, Maverick discovers a picture of Sefa, the man who he killed at the Naval Air Station in Pensacola. This is his family, and Khalid is Sefa's brother. Maverick is caught off guard and asks the family if they know who he is. The Amins say they know who he is and claim not to blame Maverick for his part in Sefa's death. They say their son was troubled, mixed up with the wrong people, conservative radicals that don't support Western influence. We see how disgusted and fearful they are of the dangerous extremists in their own land and how hopeful they are for change. Khalid comes home in the middle of the discussion. He's angry and looks like he may have been in a fight. Khalid's odd behavior confuses and concerns Maverick. He begins to doubt the benign nature of his new friend, despite the kindness of the other Amins. Then a phone call from Khalid and Sefa's sister comes in, checking on the family. When she hears Maverick is there, she asks to speak with him. She tells him to stay away, and Khalid agrees. Maverick should go. Class the next day is tense. The whole base is discussing the bombing. Khalid goes up against Maverick in combat training, and Maverick gets scared. Images of Sefa in the market aftermath corrupting his concentration. Maverick breaks away, but a car pulls up and asks him to get in. Inside is a woman. She's beautiful. Her hair is exposed. She even shakes Maverick's hand. Her name is Miriam, and she's Sefa's sister. Miriam takes Maverick to a movie theater where young couples are risking being seen dating. Miriam tells Maverick about the religious, traditionalist, and government influence that has kept Saudi Arabian culture so rigid, but she says times must change. She's a lawyer and a social activist, and it's made her a target by her own people. The woman, The women, covered in headscarves and abayas, and the men in their thobes, sit in the theater and stare at Miriam and Maverick. It's pretty obvious they don't belong there. She tells them that her family has already met with great strife over their break from traditional views, and her outspoken nature doesn't help, but both Sepha and Khalid have had it the hardest, defending their family in many physical altercations. Sepha was actively being recruited by a local terrorist group, then abruptly went to America for aviation training. She still doesn't know if what he did was a terrorist act or a way to keep from coming home. She's afraid that Khalid may be in a similar situation. She knows that the same group has approached him as well. She asks Maverick to watch and protect her brother. Maverick deals with the tension of his unintended integration into the Amin family, unsure if he can trust Khalid digging into the men he sees the Saudi pilot meet with off base. He reports back to Miriam each time, becoming more familiar with her, and romance blooms, but eventually the drama comes to a head. Maverick discovers too late that Khalid has given a group of men access to the base, and with an explosive distraction, the bomber jets are stolen to be used for an airstrike on a nearby city. Many of Maverick's students and the top pilots at the base are wounded or killed, and the drone control center is demolished. Maverick confronts Khalid about what he's done. He says he had no choice. The men had threatened to kill Miriam and the entire Min family if he hadn't helped them. Khalid and Maverick agree the terrorists must be stopped, but there's only a handful of pilots, and the only planes left are the old F-4 Phantoms. The Saudi and American pilots take to the skies and track down the terrorists, and after a thrilling dogfight, bring them down and save the city. The incident has been reported worldwide, and the international pilots are pouring into American training facilities with renewed interest in traditional dogfighting techniques. Maverick's called back home to help and asks Miriam to go with him. She says no, there's too much to be done for her own people, but she says he's family now. They part, and we close with Maverick on a commercial flight, flying into the sunset, headed back to America. For both the look and keeping it within the family, I'd like Ridley Scott to direct. Tom would play Maverick. I'd like all Saudi actors for Miriam, Khalid, and Sepha. And as many of the Saudi parts as possible, just to give it, you know, that genuine sort of feel. And I know it's a little bit long and detailed, but I kind of had to write out whole scenes there to get through it. So it's not a true synopsis, but yeah, that's it. And I actually failed to come up with a name for it. yeah, so we'll keep Top Gun Maverick, but I don't actually know if that's the title I'd go with.
Yeah, you got deep into the weeds on that one, but it's a good story. I feel like I saw the movie just then. Yeah, I took a different approach this time. And I did something very similar to what you did, because I do feel like I didn't want to misstep or say the wrong thing and just hurt anybody's feelings. So I wrote a little thing, a warning up front. I know very little about our military or the subject matter, aside from what I've learned from movies and the occasional interaction with a friend who served. I've never served myself, but respect all men and women who have served for our freedom. So if I say something stupid, just remember what I just said. I'm going to skip. I do have a title. I have a cast. I'm not going to share that with you yet, but I am going to share that I would like the director to be Michael Bay.
Okay.
Just given the experience with Simpson and Bruckheimer and Michael Bay and the number of movies they've done together. Plus, I feel like the original Top Gun, like you said, very dramatic, no comedy. It lacked that. I think that would put it over the top. So I'd like to see a little bit of that interjected into this new film. And it's funny that you brought it up before we started. I decided to go a different direction this time. I know what we're getting from Top Gun Maverick from the trailers, and it is just another one of these where the same amount of time has progressed and we're here with the same character. I don't want to do that for this one. I know that's what we're getting, but I wrote something different. So Tom Cruise is referenced but not featured in the film. Mm-hmm. In 2020, being invited to the Top Gun flight school is still one of the highest honors in the American military program, but things have changed drastically since 1986. Today's military still relies on fighter jets, but some of those are now remotely flown by pilots, I put in quotes, in military outposts far from their aircraft. The 2020 Top Gun flight school class commences to find a group of 30 new recruits, 15 actual fighter pilots from within the ranks of the military, and 15 remote pilots recruited via the simulation video games that they played online and dominated in at esports tournaments. One such game was called Maverick, where players had unknowingly been trying to best the performance of the real-life Top Gun graduate and legend from the 80s. Again, he's referenced but never shown, so they don't know that what they're doing is actually a test to see if they'll be invited into the Top Gun program. This is a new thing. As with any film of this genre, there's tension between the two recruit groups, especially between the real pilots and the video game pros who are brought on to replace them. Much like in the original film, there are exercises and challenges that pit the instructors against the young recruits, and the competitive nature is elevated between those sets of recruits. So you get the same kind of tension that you had in the first one, but now you've got two cliques, two very defined groups within that training. Near the end of their training, the new pilots are called into action against an unknown enemy, but on American soil. This anonymous group flies unpiloted jets built right here in the U.S. and has attacked several landmarks around the states simply to show their power. After each mission, their aircraft detonate, leaving our military unable to track them back to their origin or establish who's been deploying them. I wrote that in there because I'm like, we got GPS satellites in all the time. It would be easy to just fly them back home, right?
Right.
Or track them back home. Nope. They're like 3D printing these things and destroying them. This anonymous group, who I've codenamed TACMOT, T-A-C-M-O-T, which is just Tomcat backwards, has threatened to attack the White House and kill the president unless their demands are met. As required by movie law, the line, "We do not bargain with terrorists," is uttered in response to their demands, and it's game on. It's movie law.
It is.
The two groups of Top Gun pilots come together to fight off the attack, and during the battle, one character, who I like the idea of... you know how they have their call signs? And in the first movie, they're all these like really masculine, badass animals like Viper and Iceman, all this stuff. I like the idea that these new guys who are brought on have gamer tags.
Oh, okay.
And that would be their call sign. So the main character, his code name is Wolf, but it's W01F.
Nice.
Much like you would see with gamer tags now. The two groups of Top Gun pilots come together to fight off the attack, and during their battle, one of the characters is actually able to track the anonymous signal back to where they're controlling their planes, using some of his hidden talents. I put that in air quotes. It turns out that he was a gamer and a hacker who had been arrested and cut a deal to participate in the program to reduce his sentence. After defeating the enemy's aircraft, the Top Gun graduates take the battle to the base of the anonymous crew, only to find out that it was all run by the son of a fallen pilot from the Top Gun program, maybe even someone we were familiar with from the first Top Gun film. Hmm. So I kept this one more general. I liked just the basic idea of it. Instead of being a foreign enemy, it's actually something right here on our soil.
Yeah.
And then I like the idea of... yeah, things have changed, and we do know there are these drone programs, and that's going a step further, and where are they getting these talented kids from that can fly these planes? So, thus the esports and the gaming aspect coming in, which I feel like there's some games they put out now, some shooter games, and I think you can play some on the official sites for these different military branches. Mm. I feel like they're already doing this.
Yeah, it's,
I feel like they're looking to see who has those skill sets.
It's very Last Starfighter, like... this is
exactly
active recruiting through the video game. Mm-hmm.
Plus that for sure. So I told you my director is Michael Bay.
Mm-hmm.
My cast is Nicholas Holt as Wolf. He's that the gamer. John Boyega as one of the traditional fighter pilots. And then because I feel like, okay, you've got you need to work in more people of color. That's why you brought in John Boyega. You need your main character. I feel like Nicholas Holt kind of comes off and could be that cocky young kid.
Yeah, I like him.
And then you need... yeah, he's great. I just watched a movie on Apple Plus with him, Sam Jackson, and Anthony Mackie that was really good about banking in the 60s. Anyway, and then finally, Jennifer Lawrence, because I feel like you also need to work in the fact that women are now allowed into the program, which they were not mm-hmm. in the 80s. And there were some really sexist remarks by Val Kilmer, Iceman, in that film that were now don't play well at all with audiences. So I feel like you got to bring in Jennifer Lawrence, somebody else of that caliber, to play a female lead in the program, not just the love interest. And because I think he'd be great in this role, John Hamm as one of their instructors.
Yeah.
Because I just like him. He can be a real dick, which is perfect for this kind of role. And the dude looks good in the uniform. So, and the title of my movie? Very simple. Top Gun, Need for Speed.
I feel the need for speed.
I'm surprised. I'm really surprised that's not the title of this, the new one.
I mean, honestly, we talked about it a lot after I watched the movie last weekend, and I really struggled with a premise for this one because I just don't think we need a sequel to Top Gun, honestly. Now, I may watch the film and go, oh, okay, they figured it out. I'm fine with this. This is cool. But I don't know.
Well, I agree. I think I really like yours, by the way. I think I can totally see that actually being not only a Michael Bay movie, but something that they would want to consider as a nice follow-up to the Top Gun story. The only problem there is that, which I was surprised you did, is not having Tom Cruise in it, because that obviously they're going to push for that. So not they have to work off the name of the movie, but also Tom Cruise as the actor. Like, you know, that there's no way they're going to make a Top Gun movie. Now, I think, and in both our movies maybe have a shot at this, where they don't necessarily have to be Top Gun movies. They could be movies on their own that don't really relate to this franchise. Like, my guy could be a washed up, you know, dogfight instructor. He didn't have to be Top Gun anything. You're telling a unique story with this whole recruitment sort of aspect with modern gaming and everything, and all that's very interesting. I could totally see both of those being made. I like that neither of us, but well, that was kind of my nod, was I had the whole thing in there where my new Top Gun guy, I shot him in the face like within the first 10 minutes of the movie, because I was basically saying, this is not that movie. And I named him Evan, because that's his original name in the script, actually. It wasn't Pete, it was Evan Mitchell.
That's why it sounded familiar. Yeah. That's right.
Cool. I really like both of those. Yeah, I agree. I don't think we need another Top Gun. And we proved this in our rewatch, is that I think we look back on that with way more fondness than deserves. Like, it was very much about, we watched that at a time when it was pretty epic and it was big and we were willing to spend money on that sort of thing. But it's very dated. It's very much like, it doesn't have a lot of rewatchability. It's not a great movie. It's an okay movie, and okay movies, you watch them once and you toss them. You wait for the next movie that's basically the same thing with a different title. That's all they're going with. They're using the title and basically our nostalgia against us.
I really wonder how many, let's call them 25 years old and younger, have seen Top Gun and how many have not. Mm. And I think you made a reference to it earlier, so the sequel's coming out, and I always thought about this, like, they must have, in their formula for making money on these, they must think, okay, once we produce the sequel, what can we do with the original one to bank and make a ton more money off of it at the same time? Like, I just saw a bunch of Tom Cruise movies are for the first time ever becoming available in 4K, and Top Gun was one of the ones they announced in the last week and a half. So... I'm surprised it's on any of the streaming services. I would have thought by now they would have taken it off so they could capitalize on the movie sales on disc or on digital. But they're not showing the 4K version. So I always thought that was interesting. Right. Did they factor that in when they're making a sequel and go, okay, we know the sequel's going to make this, but the original one is now going to make this much more. So as a whole, this is why it's a profitable film.
I'm sure there's an uptick in sales, like especially if it's affordable enough, and we have it now where we can you can rent or buy these for not all that expensive of a price off of a lot of platforms, right? So we could buy probably Top Gun for what, $6 or $7 right now, probably. I mean, so they're gonna make a decent coin on that. And I think it all factors in. I mean, that's why they do this, right? Like, we've talked about that, and we're going to keep talking about it. That's the whole point of this podcast, is that they're going to build off of what they've already made, because there is money to be made off of that original franchise. And, whether or not we need or want these movies, they're going to get made because there's money to be made.
Yeah, absolutely true. The one thing I will not allow myself to do, maybe there's maybe one exception, is go, nope, it's a sequel I didn't want, so I'm never going to watch it. I just don't think that makes any sense. I'll at least go give it one try, see what it's all about, and I'm going to watch it to the end. I don't care how bad it is. I'm going to watch it all the way through the closing credits, and then maybe go, you know what? That was the one time I'm ever going to see this. Or, hey, turns out it's pretty good. I was wrong. Now we've got a nice two films. When are we getting the trilogy, you know? The one exception might be Back to the Future. I don't want them to ever reboot Back to the Future or do some crappy-ass sequel.
But they will. And we'll probably have to have it as one of our podcasts. So the actual Top Gun Maverick, no matter how awesome our movies will be, is coming out. Here's the synopsis, okay? After more than 30 years of service as one of the Navy's top aviators, and this is my first time to read it, I literally copied and pasted it from Wikipedia without reading.
Oh, smart.
Pete Maverick Mitchell, Tom Cruise, is where he belongs, pushing the envelope as a courageous test pilot and dodging the advancement in rank that would ground him. When he finds himself training a detachment of Top Gun graduates for a specialized mission, the likes of which no living pilot has ever seen, Maverick encounters Lieutenant Bradley Bradshaw, played by Miles Teller, call sign Rooster, the son of Maverick's late best friend and radar intercept officer, Lieutenant Nick Bradshaw, known as Goose. Facing an uncertain future, so you had his son come back and so are they. Facing an uncertain future and confronting the ghosts of his past, Maverick is drawn into a confrontation with his own deepest fears, culminating in a mission that demands the ultimate sacrifice from those who will be chosen to fly it. Okay. So
still pretty vague.
Yeah. So basically he's gonna basically be reliving his nightmare of his Rio, which they said Rio a dozen times in the movie, where I never actually heard what it stood for. It's radar intercept officer. I had to read that separately. Rio is like your not your wingman, but the guy riding with you. That's it. That's Goose for him. So yeah, he's going to be a new mission, but same thing where he's going to be worried the whole time about losing.
Can I just say before you go on, because I know you got some more info there, but Miles Teller is great casting in this because he's a good actor, but he plays a dick so well. Like, everything he's in, I look at him and go, God, what a dick. Like, immediately. I don't know what it is about it. Is his face or the way he talks? I don't know what it is, but I think this is perfect to play that role as some young, pissed-off kid.
Yeah, I agree. He does have that look. There are some people that you're just like, oh, well, if I ever met him at a party, I'd probably instantly go excuse myself because I really don't want to have a conversation with him, and I doubt he would have a conversation with me. but as an actor, I really dig him. Whiplash is one of my favorite movies. That movie is 100% like near perfect as a movie you can make. Like, it's just excellent. So you apparently nailed it. I don't know if you saw this or not, but John Hamm is in Top Gun.
Okay, maybe I saw the trailer, and he was in the trailer, and I just didn't connect that I had seen it. I bet that's what it was. Yeah. I'm not that good by any means.
I'd have John Hamm in every movie.
Right?
That's great. I agree.
And he can do it all, too.
He does, yeah. Drama, comedy, I like him. He's great. He's the opposite of Miles Teller, where he's instantly likable.
I like Ed Harris.
Yeah, me too. Ed Harris I would have in a lot of stuff too. Jennifer Connelly's in there. I haven't seen her, honestly, in anything in a long time. I'm trying to remember the last thing I saw her in was maybe, Dark City? That's the last thing
She was in Beautiful Mind.
Yes,
You want to know a real interesting fact about Jennifer Connelly is in the MCU, her real-life husband, Paul Bettany, played Jarvis, the voice of Jarvis, and then eventually became Vision. And then when Jarvis was replaced, Tony Stark had to replace it with Friday. Friday is voiced by Jennifer Connelly. Isn't that cool?
That is awesome. That's really great. And I always liked her. I forgot she was in Beautiful Mind. She was really good
career
in that.
Opportunities. Yeah. I could watch that every day for the rest of my life.
Yeah, that's one I don't want them to redo it, but I do want more people to see that movie.
Amen.
Val Kilmer's also going to be back as Iceman. So, I mean, there's good people in it, but honestly, I really don't know how this movie's going to turn out. When the movie was in discussion in 2010, Tony Scott was going to direct again. We talked about, unfortunately, after his suicide. Joseph Kosinski is directing. Kosinski's first feature-length movie was Tron Legacy, followed by Oblivion, and Only the Brave. I like Tron Legacy. I felt there was some CG mishaps there, and but overall, I actually think it's a pretty cool movie. And Oblivion with Tom Cruise.
Yeah, I like that movie, actually.
Me too. I really enjoy that movie. I've watched it a few times.
Yeah, I don't know why that's not higher on people's radars.
I don't know. Writers. Jim Cash, writer on the original Top Gun, died in 2000, but both he and Epps are given writers' credits for Top Gun Maverick. The credit is for the characters. Okay. Of the actual writers for Top Gun Maverick, there are five. Whoa. Aaron Kruger, Eric Warren Singer, Christopher McQuarrie, Peter Craig, and Justin Marks. And I'm telling you, five writers is a strong indication of how potentially bad this script will be. There was even word that Ashley Miller and Zach Stentz, writers of Thor and X-Men First Class, were supposed to be in negotiations, but that obviously fell through. It's too many chefs in the kitchen, right? It's not a good sign.
It depends, though. Like, or is it five writing simultaneously, or did each of these take a stab at it and somebody like Christopher McQuarrie, who's an established and a very good writer, came in and cleaned it all up into one good story?
But it's a Band-Aid, right? Usually it's like, unless you have somebody start over.
Could be.
This whole, the idea, well, I mean, it's, the script obviously wasn't good. They had to call in somebody, if not two or three other people, to be like, how can we make this better? And then they're going to fix a few scenes here and there. They're going to maybe add a little bit of depth to a character, but usually it's, you can still tell that it was not as cohesive as it would have been with just one or two writers. Yeah. For the benefit of optimism, though, I do want to do a quick rundown on the writers. Kruger has done thrillers, which is ironic, and horror like Arlington Road, The Ring, and Scream 3. Singer wrote American Hustle. McQuarrie, The Usual Suspects, Edge of Tomorrow, Valkyrie, Jack Reacher. Obviously, he's a Tom Cruise guy. Craig wrote The Town and The Hunger Games Mockingjay, and Marks wrote The Jungle Book. So, I mean, there's decent stuff in there, right? Like Arlington Road, not a lot of people talk about that movie, but it's a pretty cool movie. The Ring, I really like. Everything from McQuarrie there, I enjoy.
That's a crazy group of people. Yeah. Like, I would never put them all in a room and say, hey, we're looking for a Top Gun sequel. Make it happen.
Yeah. All right, so we'll have to see with the rest of people, and that's going to come out on July 17th, 2020. Maybe. We really don't.
You know, I saw a thing today that AMC basically publicly stated that they doubt they would be open at all this summer. So yeah. I have a feeling this one could get pushed back probably even to 2021 at this point.
Yeah, it'll be weird because, you know, especially these people that do want, they already know, like they've already planned everything. It's going to be the summer film, right? Like there's a lot of those. Every summer we know, everybody knows we're getting these summer films. They're ready to go to the theaters. And yeah, do we, bring it out a few months later? Now it's not a summer movie? Or do you literally wait an entire year to do it again? I could see that happening. I could see them pushing it out just a solid year.
It'll be really interesting to see, and this is not related just to Top Gun, but as these films are pushed back, that many had already started spending, like Top Gun, a lot of money on advertising, that we all know that the average American or moviegoer, they have a very short attention span. If this ends up coming out in 2021, how does a movie studio that spends probably $20, $30, $40 million in advertising, did they have to start the whole thing over again? And how badly does that hurt the bottom line for the movie or other movies that they were planning on doing? I really wonder, like, could they effectively just pause the advertising and then pick it up a week before the movie comes out again? It's going to be very interesting to see what they do. And are they going up against more movies than ever? Because once production picks back up, they've all pushed these all back. Are we going to get an influx?
Yeah. But then, I mean, there's only so many studios putting out stuff, so there's going to be their own competition in a lot of ways. So they'll figure out the calendar all over again.
That's true.
Yeah. All right. I do want to get over into some fun trivia, fun facts, things we've learned, stuff,
and
That is cool things. About the movie.
I love this part. I loved reading these before we ever did one of these podcasts, and now this gives me an excuse to look at it for some of my favorite movies, which is, there's some cool stuff in here for sure.
Yeah. Everybody always likes to hear what really happened behind the scenes, or what, you know, what is the little tweaks and funny stuff that happened that we never would have discovered otherwise.
Want to just do our typical back and forth?
Yeah, yeah.
Right, I'll kick it off here with the first one, if that's okay.
Cool.
Tom Cruise had to wear lifts, no surprise, in his scenes with Kelly McGillis. Mm. Cruise is only 5'7", while McGillis was 5'10".
Mm. Nice. In the script, Maverick's first name was Evan. Oh, I did leave that in there. It was changed to Pete in the final film as a tip of the hat to the technical advisor Pete Viper Pettigrew, seen in the film as the man Charlie is meeting at the bar in her first appearance in the film.
I wondered who that guy was when I was watching. I was like, that's weird to call him out but not have him in the movie. Next one. The real Top Gun school imposes a $5 fine to any staff member that quotes the movie. I love this. I can imagine if I went there, I would try to quote lines from the movie that no one knew just to see if I could get away with it.
That's a great idea. Well, and it's only $5. You could do the entire script and only spend like maybe $100. Riding on the back of this film's success, the U.S. Navy set up recruiting booths in the major cinemas to try and catch some of the adrenaline-charged guys leaving the screenings. They had the highest applications rate for years as a result.
That really makes sense, honestly. Good on them. Yeah. For the opening of the film, director Tony Scott wanted to shoot aircraft taking off and landing on the aircraft carrier, backlit by the sun. The carrier captain had changed course of the ship, and when Scott asked if the ship could continue on the previous course and speed, he was told that turning the ship cost $25,000. Scott then wrote the captain a quick $25,000 check so the ship could be turned and he could keep shooting for another 5 minutes. According to Scott, the check bounced. I love that. So good.
Yeah. 25,000. Michael Ironside stated in the DVD commentary that he was so convincing as an officer that when he heard someone running toward him below deck, he got onto the sailor who was running. The sailor saluted and slowed down until he got out of Ironside's line of sight and started running again. The sailor never knew that Ironside was an actor on the film.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah, if Michael Ironside told me to do anything, I would do it. Like, that dude is intimidating.
Cougar was supposed to have crashed while trying to land back on the carrier, and his death was supposed to be why Maverick slid into Cougar's spot. But this was summarily cut by the Navy. As this was intended to be a recruitment tool for the Navy, they didn't want negative attention drawn on a particularly hazardous aspect of serving on a carrier or flying fighters. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. This film is credited with starting the home video industry. Originally, VHS tapes were priced at $100 upon their first release and were sold mainly to video stores. This film was priced to own immediately upon release, made possible by Pepsi Cola buying ad space at the beginning of the tape. Since then, pricing VHS tapes to own right away became a common practice.
Well,
interesting.
I'm going to call somewhat BS on this, since you and I have time working in video stores, many years. I didn't start working at them until 91, and the only people that were making them available at a normal price was Disney. All the other ones were still crazy priced. This must have been an experiment that didn't really take off until DVD sales many years later. Because remember when we worked at video stores, do you remember any movies being available for $19 on release day other than Disney?
Not on release day. Yeah, because they tried to span it out so they'd get the rentals
right
first, and then you could buy. Yeah, I don't,
like 90 days later maybe, but not
day
they came out for rental. Because people, when they would lose, I think we talked about this before, when somebody would lose or damage a tape, they would come in and be shocked that was $110 that they were going to have to pay. They thought it was going to be $15-$20. Or people would special order movies and would pay through the nose for the privilege to own a VHS tape that was going to deteriorate over time.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember discovering, when we saw how much it actually cost to buy these, and thinking about, oh man, you'd see like a whole section where they'd bought, you know, 50 of these copies. Most video stores at the time, these were a mom and pop sort of operations. They'd buy like two copies of something, you know, maybe four, And when they made some money back, they would get rid of a couple of them, you know, like it wasn't like with Blockbuster or whatever, where they do a whole wall. There's like 200 of them. But yeah, maybe they mean that, yeah, it was experimental, but not like the next, every movie then on did it. It's just, they tried it and then other people tried it after.
You know, it's interesting, sidebar, but something that most people probably will never have seen or never will, is when I worked at Hastings in college, we rented VHS, never DVD while I was there. And I had a report every Monday of all the movies by barcode that I would have to go pull off the shelf, because they were running a mathematical formula in the background to show when it had finally made a profit. Like if we paid $100 for it and it was rented out, you know, 50 times at $3 a rental, it had served its purpose. And then I would pull those, shrink wrap them, and sell them as the used movies, so it would make another $10. And then every Monday I'd have to pull a bunch and do that with them. It was very interesting that they had a science and an entire thing dedicated to that, to really make sure they were profiting off the movies correctly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's a decent system. But it was a gamble sometimes. They didn't really know how many copies they should order. You didn't want to over-order on some stuff and be stuck with 50 copies of something that just wasn't even going to sell, like, ever. You could price it like $2 and people weren't interested.
And then there was the real weird time. Do you remember the self-detonating VHS tapes? Instead of almost all the VHS tapes were black, there were these occasional ones that were either green or red. And inside the VHS tape, they were cheaper to buy for the video stores, but inside there was a magnet that upon every view would push one step closer to the actual reel. And after it had been viewed like 50 times, it would essentially self-erase the tape when it played on that 50th time.
I didn't know that's what that was. I do remember seeing a red tape. That's
there were only a handful. I can't remember a specific movie that we got that did that. I want to say maybe Last Boy Scout was one of those. Mm-hmm. But when we first got them, I'm like, why is this a different color? And then somebody finally told me the story. I thought it was an interesting little small trial that I don't think ever saw much legs, really.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a weird
one. Sorry, I've digressed horribly from our cool facts of Top Gun.
Nope, that's all right.
Let's see, I'll do the next one. The late Tony Scott was fired not once, not twice, but three times from the project. Part of the reason the studio sent Scott the pink slip on three different occasions was because the film ran over budget and over time. Yeah, so fire the guy so he can't finish. That makes sense.
Well, I mean, I could see that whenever you're working with the Navy and they're talking about, like, I'm not turning the ship around and this is $25,000. So yeah, probably went over budget.
And didn't we start this off by freaking out that it was only 15 mil? Like what did they have his guy? Yeah. What do they expect him to do?
I don't know. Well, it was his first like big budget movie, right? God. So I don't know, whatever. Test audience who saw the movie before it was released were annoyed that there was no love scene. The producers obliged, and 5 months after the production had wrapped, they summoned Tom Cruise and Kelly McGillis to Chicago to film the infamous elevator scene and the sex scene. During their time away from the set, McGillis had lost approximately 16 pounds. Cruise was actually filming The Color of Money, so his hair was much longer in those two scenes. McGillis' hair was also much darker, hence why she hid it underneath a cap in the elevator scene. Remember, she's wearing that hat? Yeah.
Which
looked really good.
I was going to say the same thing. She actually pulls off a hat really well.
Yeah, she's pretty hot.
The enemy is never identified. At the time, many assumed it was the Russians. Others suspected China, but everything was intentionally kept vague, including the insignias of the enemy gear and planes. More than one writer worked on the original script as well, and the treatment of the enemy changed as the story was developed. There's an article from nationalinterest.org that talks about the finale of an early draft where the North Korea was the proposed foe.
Yeah, I remember, well, especially the time period with Cold War and everything. We just, all enemies were the Russians. Like, it was just, you walked into a movie and knew. It was an easy one, right? Like, you always made the villain Russian or some foreign entity that we would easily grasp onto.
Sure, worked for Rocky IV.
Yeah, sure did. Until the end, when he unified the two countries.
Single-handedly.
Which is
single-boxing-glovedly.
Yeah, I don't know. Just took a few punches. But everybody loves each other now. I did actually find, I mentioned this earlier, reading the script. I didn't read the entire thing. I did read some of it, though. It's fun to read scripts because just trying to see what this stuff looks like on paper is interesting. And to really think about how you take something like that and then actually develop it into what it becomes is just fascinating. You can get the script. This one's by Chip Prozer, who I don't even think I mentioned above as one of the other writers. He's not given credit in IMDb, but that's at dailyscript.com. So you can go over there, and there's a bunch of stuff they have, but Top Gun is one.
That was the early draft of the original movie, not the new one, right?
Yeah, the original one, sorry.
Interesting.
Yeah. All right, well, that is it for the Top Gun episode. Hopefully you guys had a lot of fun, learned some things, got to hear our pitches for what we would like to see our versions of the Top Gun movie be. Obviously, when we can, we're all going to rush to the movie theaters and see as many things as we can. Probably a bunch of stuff we don't even care to see, but we're excited to be out and see a movie. So we'll all see Top Gun and do our own review and see if it's anything like our pitches or hopefully just somewhat entertaining. All right. Thank you very much. And I am Matt Sully.
And this is Chris Sully.
And this has been Movie Retakes.
Come on, Brad.
Let's see the family.
You shake my nerves and you rattle my brain. Leave my love, got the man insane. You broke my will, but what the hell?
Goodness gracious, great balls of